Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
And welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Frederick Wiseman has been documenting American life for over 50 years, primarily by focusing on institutions like libraries, schools, police departments, museums, hospitals, and governments. His latest film, Monrovia, Indiana, takes an in-depth look at a small farming community in the Midwest, its churches, local government stores, restaurants, and its fields, creating a quiet but unsettling portrait of daily life in the American heartland. It opens tomorrow at Film Forum on West Houston Street, and I'm honored that it has brought Frederick Wiseman to our show. Hello.
Hello.
This isn't the first time.
Thank you for that nice introduction.
Well, I almost said he is not only a great documentary filmmaker, but he's a great filmmaker.
Well, I have no objection to either.
This isn't the first time you've made a film about a small town. In 1999, you made Belfast, Maine, about a small New England coastal village. Is Monrovia, Indiana, a very different kind of place? Would that make it a different kind of film?
Well, if people have a chance to see the two films, they can compare and contrast. I think the nature of work is different. Excuse me. The nature of the work is different because Belfast is a coastal town, and certainly Monrovia, Indiana, is some distance from the sea. And the nature of the people that live in Belfast were very different than the people. I mean, at least some of the people there were different classes. You know, there was more stratification than there was in Monrovia,
which is more homogeneous.
Monrovia was much more homogeneous. And I made a movie about Aspen, Colorado, which is also a small town. And the movie I made about the Canal Zone, I mean, the Americans living in the Canal Zone in 1976, or when I made the movie, were essentially living small-town American life in Panama.
Your 2015 film, In Jackson Heights, documents a neighborhood in New York City that may be one of the most diverse places in the country. But you say Monrovia is one of the most homogeneous. Should I assume that you decided to make a film about a small town in the Midwest out of a desire to understand the results of the 2016 election?
No. I mean, I was interested, obviously, in what their politics might be, but
they barely talk about them.
They don't talk about all about it. I was quite struck by that. There was no. I heard no political talk in the 10 weeks that I was there, whether the camera was running or the camera wasn't running. Local politics, which found expression in the town council meeting, but no discussion whatsoever of national politics or even state politics.
Monrovia.
And the state politics are pretty hot there. I mean, they're beginning to warm up. Because there's a very contested senatorial race there.
Monrovia has a population of just over 1,000 people. There must be hundreds or perhaps thousands of towns of that size in the Midwest. What led you to choose Monrovia, Indiana, as your subject?
Total chance. I was talking to a friend of mine in Boston who's a law professor. And I told her I wanted to do a small town in the Midwest. She said she had a friend who taught law at the University of Indiana, whose family had lived in the same town for 6 generations, the beginning of the 19th century. And by chance, a couple of weeks later, I was going to Bloomington, where the site of the University of Indiana, to show some movies, and so I called this man up, and I told him what I was interested in doing. He said, well, come out a day early, and I'll take you to my family's town, Monrovia, and I did that, and he introduced me to his cousin, who was the town undertaker, and, you know, she knew everybody. Everybody's a potential client, she liked the idea of the movie, and she took me around Monrovia for a couple hours the day I was there, and I thought it looked great. Visually it looked great. I didn't know obviously anything about it, except the little that she told me. But I told her I wanted to do the film, and I went away, and over the next couple of weeks, she called the head of the town council and the head of the school board and the police department and talked to some restaurant owners and the owner of the supermarket and the vet, and they all said fine. And then after she told me she called them, I called them. So when I arrived there 4 or 5 weeks later, everybody was, you know, had been told about the film, who was happy to be in it.
The people in the town seem to be overwhelmingly Caucasian, and the only churches we see are Christian. Are the people of other ethnicities or religions living there?
Well, I think, particularly in one sequence in the film, in the band concert sequence in the high school, you see 4 or 5 blacks. I think the town is probably 98% white.
Which is interesting because they share a name with the capital of a West African country.
Well, but it's named after, both were named after an American president.
Is Monrovia, does the name go all the way back to the 19th century?
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's a good question because I don't really know that it's named after James Monroe. I always assumed that.
Mm-hmm. How long did you spend filming in Monrovia?
10 weeks.
And you filmed at town council meetings, farm equipment auctions, in shops and restaurants, at a tattoo parlor, a wedding, and a funeral. Was it your goal to film as many of the local institutions and businesses as possible?
Exactly. I mean, that was my goal. I mean, because I thought that was a way of showing what daily life was like there. It was a way of getting at this. I mean, the theme that cuts across all my films is ordinary experience. And that was a way of getting at ordinary experience in Monrovia.
I'd imagine that most people in New York will watch this film, all 143 minutes of it, and say, well, that's not for me.
Well, I mean, I suppose a lot of people in Monrovia seeing a film about New York might say the same thing.
How did the people of Monrovia treat you and your crew? Were they friendly?
They were extremely cordial and friendly and helpful. And I showed them the movie at the end of August, and they seemed to like it. They were very nice. You can't make a movie like this without people cooperating, because if there's resistance, you can't film.
But you don't shoot inside their homes. The film shows the exteriors of the homes, also the fields, the schools, and what seems to be most of the businesses.
I didn't ask. I deliberately didn't do that because I was concerned that if I went to one home, that it would be seen as representative, and I don't like the idea of that, mm-hmm. of something being representative. So I didn't do that.
That's been the policy in pretty much all of your films about areas.
With a few exceptions, in Belfast there's some home visits because I was following the visiting nurse. But I wasn't. It wasn't about just daily life in a family, without no representative of the state present, or the city, the town, or whatever. No, I've always done that. And there, in public housing, there are a couple of scenes in people's apartments, but there were scenes when somebody from the public housing authority was also there.
Do you follow those stories after, for example, all the problems that NYCHA has gone through recently?
That who has gone through?
NYCHA, the New York City Housing Authority.
No.
Because there's been a major scandal and heads have rolled.
This
film shows the exteriors of the homes, but there are a lot of empty streets, a lot of shots of empty streets with no people visible. Sometimes
well,
feels like
out
a
working.
Ghost town.
They're out working.
They're out working.
I mean, the shots are all daytime shots, and by and large, people are, you know, out working their jobs. You know, either on the farm or as a carpenter or a plumber or whatever they might be doing. So there isn't much traffic on the street during, you know, there's cars going back and forth. And people dropping in the restaurants for breakfast or lunch or dinner. But the streets were always, you know, empty during the day. And in fact, there's only one, you know, there's the main street and a couple of side streets off the main street, and that's the town. I mean, that's the downtown, so to speak, and then there are the surrounding areas. But, there, no, it's not like a big city where there's a lot of people walking on the sidewalk.
But there's lovely...
You know, some places there's no sidewalk.
There's lovely footage of cornfields, grain silos, pigs being herded, and auctions selling large pieces of farm equipment like combines. Is farming the main economic activity of this area?
Yeah.
Are we talking about small farms or is big
agribusiness? Well, you know, it depends what you mean by small farms. I think, you know, they range anywhere from 100 to 500 acres.
But this is not an area of agribusiness.
No. No, it's not. As far as I know, there was no agribusiness there at all.
The local businesses seem, other than farming, seem to be a cafe, pizza shop, a barbershop, hair salon, an auto body shop, a supermarket, a gun shop, liquor store. Just
well,
the basics.
Well, and grain silos.
And then there's a tattoo parlor. Are tattoos popular there?
I guess so. Enough to support a tattoo. I don't know what you call somebody does a tattooist. I don't know what you call it.
I don't know either, but somebody who does tattoos.
Right.
And that struck me as surprising in a town that only had 1,000 people. How much business can a tattoo artist do?
I don't know. I was only in the parlor once.
And we'll talk
and,
about
and to film, I might say, yes. not because I got a tattoo.
Frederick Wiseman's latest film is Monrovia, Indiana, and it opens tomorrow at Film Forum on West Houston Street. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Many of the residents we see are older, like the group of retirees chatting about their health problems in the local cafe.
Yeah, actually, a couple of them were retired, but most of them were still active farmers. But the ones that were the guy that talks about his illness had pretty much retired. But most of them were still pretty active. But and there was a group of men that started coming in at 6:30 in the morning, you know, in various combinations, showed up till about 10:30 to have coffee or eggs or whatever breakfast, and you know they call themselves the Liars Club. And they would sit around and shoot the breeze. And it was a good place to hang out because, as you can see from the film, they talked about their lives and their experience. And they sort of kidded around with each other.
So there's a real sense of community in a way that you wouldn't have found in Jackson Heights?
Well, I mean, it depends what's meant by a sense of community. In a town of, you know, around 1,000 people, everybody knows everybody else. In Jackson Heights, there are 150,000 people in a very small area. And my guess is that the merchants on, say, 73rd Street in Jackson Heights know each other, but they may not know the merchants on 86th Street.
Whereas in Monrovia, there is no 86th Street.
There's just one Monrovia, Mason. There's no, yeah, that's right.
Most of go ahead.
Yeah, no, and because they, you know, and a lot of them, as I think, I hope it's evident from some of the sequences, they've known each other since grammar school. You know, everybody knows, you know, pretty much everybody else.
Do you think that's the appeal of a small town?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about small towns in general to talk about, you know, to answer that.
Most of the young people are in high school or working at the pizza shop. Is this a place where most of the kids leave after they graduate high school, go to college, and then on to jobs and excitement in big cities?
Well, I'm not sure the answer to that question. I think some leave and some stay. And some leave and come back.
They come back to work and raise families.
Well,
they
come
work
back
on a farm,
or they work. They, you know, they continue the family farm, or they work in Indianapolis, which is still only about 40 minutes away, and they live in Monrovia. Or they, you know, they work in the family business. Basically, I don't know the answer to that question. I think what I've said is generally true, but I'm not, you know, I have no real knowledge of it.
Is it your sense that a fair number of them commute to Indianapolis every day to work?
Well, I think some of the people who live in that new community called Homestead that it's discussed in the town council meeting commute to work to Indianapolis or to areas around Indianapolis, because there's a big superhighway about 5 miles outside of town that goes directly to Indianapolis.
In that town council meeting, many of the members expressed a resistance to development and growth.
Right.
While the others argued that new development will bring younger people into the town.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's probably a conflict that exists in a lot of places, because some people prefer that the town doesn't change, and others think, well, I mean, somebody says, well, because of the development, Homestead development, the football team is better, or they got a sewage treatment plant. So, I mean, the film doesn't take any sides in that division of opinion, but rather it shows that it exists.
You've said in the past that your films are not unbiased accounts of their subjects. Is that because it's impossible to be completely unbiased?
Well, I mean, I think my films are completely subjective. I don't see how they could be anything else. I mean, people who talk about objectivity is just bullshit. Because a film, my film or anybody else's film, is made up of, you know, I'm not a mathematician, but 50, 100,000 choices or possible choices. You know, subject matter, what to shoot, what not to shoot, how you shoot it, what you use. I mean, from Monrovia, the ratio of film shot to film used was close to 60 to 1. So that the final film is made up of choices that I made based on criteria that I hope to a large extent I was aware of and to some extent not aware of. But, you know, the whole subjective-objective thing is beyond me, because it seems so obvious that it's totally subjective.
So you must have spent a lot of time in the editing room.
A year.
And a lot longer than you spent in Monrovia.
You're right.
Were you surprised by things that you found while you were editing?
Yeah, well, because during the shooting, you recognize, you know, you say, well, that's a good sequence. And sometimes in the editing room, that original response is confirmed, and sometimes you wonder why you thought it originally. The film is, you make or break the film in the editing. Because you can have good material and screw it up, and you can have mediocre material and improve it somewhat. And I have no idea in advance, either in advance of the shooting or in advance, when the film is shot, in advance of the editing, what the themes are going to be till I study the material. The rushes are like my notes. You know, I'm doing a PhD thesis, and I come back to the from the library with 20 notebooks full of my notes from the books I've read. Well, that's what the rushes are. And then I have to find the movie in the rushes. It's the old cliche of the sculptor finding the statue under the stone. I have to study the material, and however illusory it might be, I have to think that I have to convince myself that I understand what's going on in the sequence in order to make the decision, one, whether I want to use it, two, how to cut it down to a usable form, and three, where to place it.
And unlike a story film, you have to find the story.
I have to find the story. I mean, I think my film, at least I hope my films are dramatic narratives, but not in a traditional way. I mean, there is a story, but the story usually has to do with the ideas that are suggested by the choice and order of sequences.
Do you go into a project with any preconceived notions?
Not really. Because, I mean, I spent 2 hours in Monrovia before I started shooting. The shooting is the research. I mean, each film is a gamble. You know, the model is Las Vegas. You roll the dice, you take a chance. If you hang around long enough, you'll accumulate enough sequences out of which a film can be cut. But I really don't I can't really have any idea of the themes because I don't know what I'm going to... I don't know anything about the place, as in the case of Monrovia, which is often the situation. And two, I don't know what I'm going to come across. So it's a combination of luck and judgment and an attempt to think about the implications of what's been shot.
Because unless you have...
I mean, that's why, for me, making these movies is so interesting, because it makes a demand on all my resources, physical, emotional, and intellectual.
And if you don't have something dramatic occurring while you're shooting, somebody, suddenly the police have to deal with a problem, then you have to find drama in other ways.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but you find drama and you find comedy. I mean, I'm not the first to discover that, you know, that ordinary experience is filled with sadness, tragedy, comedy, indifference, banality, etc. And, you know, part of my job is to recognize those kinds of events when they occur and get them, and, you know, get them in the rushes.
Are you ever surprised by what you find?
Always, because I don't know anything about the place to begin with. I mean, that's part of the fun. That's why it's an adventure. Because before I started Monrovia, I read Winesburg, Ohio when I was in college, and I'd made these other movies about small towns, but every place is different. And the whole point, as far as I'm concerned, is to be trying to be open enough to the experience of being there so that I'm not imposing a preconceived view on the material, but I can respond to what is happening and try and get it for the film.
The reason I ask is because if you're shooting something like Titicut Follies, you know you're going to get a lot of interesting material. But
right.
But when you go to a small town, you can't be sure that much is going to happen or that you're going to like the people or that...
That's right. But that's part of the adventure. You know what I mean? That's why it's a roll of the dice.
And you're not looking to do any Titicut Follies anymore?
Well, no. I mean, anybody who made a film about Bridgewater, which is the prison where the Follies was made, in 1966, you know, would have come... I mean, it was a horrible place. Because the staff... The medical and psychiatric staff was incompetent or practically non-existent, and the guards were well-meaning but totally untrained. And the place offered absolutely no services to either rehabilitate or any way help the inmates. It was basically just a place to dump people and treat them, some of them, quite badly. So that, you know, that's a different subject matter. Some people think that I make expose movies. I don't think I do that. I mean, Tittycut Follies, I mean, as I indicated a moment ago, it was such a horrible place. You couldn't make a movie about that without showing how bad it was. But that's not true of a lot of the subjects I've selected. I mean, somebody once said, I think they said it about La Danse, which is a movie I made about the Paris Opera Ballet, that it wasn't, quote, Wiseman-esque, unquote. And what I think that meant was that I wasn't showing poor people being exploited. And, you know, even in a movie like Welfare, I mean, the movie shows the wide variety of people who are asking for help from the state through one or another of the various programs that Welfare offers. But it also is, but it doesn't show the workers treating them badly. It shows occasionally the workers being impatient, but it also shows occasionally the workers desperately trying to find a way of helping people. And it raises questions about what the role of the state is in helping people who are clearly incapable of holding jobs and supporting themselves. So it tries to deal with the subject of welfare in a complex, unidimensional way rather than a simple-minded. I mean, I don't know if you ever saw that Ken Loach movie he made a year or two ago about a welfare office in London. Well, it was so simple-minded and so one-dimensional. I mean, the welfare recipients were all noble, kind, good people, crushed by the state, and the welfare workers were all mean and uncaring and insensitive. I mean, that's ridiculous.
But when you look at a film like Welfare, which was shot quite a while ago,
in
a very different America, it still tells us something about our current situation vis-a-vis welfare.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Which is interesting because we still haven't resolved some of our issues with things like welfare.
Right. I mean, welfare is a vast and complex subject where the state in its various forms is spending hundreds of billions of dollars to offer services to people, such a wide variety of services to people. And the people running the welfare have the responsibility to do as well as they can in offering the services and being responsible for the money that the state is making available. So, I mean, I don't know. And so the film, as far as I'm concerned, the film tries to deal with those questions, or at least suggest those questions, not necessarily in no way resolve them, but to suggest those questions. From my point of view, it's a complex portrait of a lot of the issues surrounding the demand for and the offer of assistance. And it's not, I mean, I think it's a cheat, to do it in a simple-minded way, because it's extraordinarily complex, a whole series of extraordinarily complex questions.
Filmmaker Frederick Wiseman, who's been making important documentaries for over 50 years, is my guest today on Let It Lopate at Large. Frederick Wiseman's latest film is Monrovia, Indiana, and it opens tomorrow at Film Forum on West Houston Street. How many films have you made so far?
I think it's 45.
Wow. So it's almost one a year, a little under one
a year.
Yeah,
no, I was a little slug a bit for a while.
You filmed a long scene for this film in a gun shop, men discussing the merits of various firearms. Is that a place where Monrovia is a place where almost everyone owns guns?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know, but a lot of the farmers do. A lot of people, I mean, they hunt.
Mm-hmm. And what are they comparing notes about?
Well, in that particular scene, they're admiring a pistol, and they're talking about hunting, but they're also talking about baseball, and they're talking about how one of their friends is just had his bladder removed, and somebody else is talking about how his wife needs to have the bladder removed, and I mean it's just ordinary chit chat in the context of visiting a gun shop and examining talking about ammunition and the various weapons that are available for purchase.
You said earlier that Donald Trump's name never really was mentioned while you were there.
I didn't hear, not only did I never hear Donald Trump's name, I never heard any mention of politics at all.
But there is a shot of a Republican Party booth at the Monrovia
right.
Festival.
Exactly.
You don't have one of a Democratic booth, so...
I did because I didn't see it.
So we're assuming that most of the residents here are Republicans. Is it your sense that politics is something that just isn't talked about, or perhaps not when the cameras are running?
I have to interrupt for because I'm here with Mike to approve an ad that has to run in the paper tomorrow. So can I interrupt for a minute? Is that all right?
Okay, well, just while you do, a reminder that this is the next to last day that we're offering the New York Review of Books to our listeners who become members of WBAI, become sustaining members at the tune of $10 a month, 6 months of the New York Review of Books, publication that has done extensive reviews of Frederick Weisman's films over the years because he is such an important filmmaker. $10 a month will get you 6 months of what has to be one of the most prestigious literary publications in the world. We hope that when you do become a member by calling 516-620-3602 or by going to givetowbai.org, that's give and then the number to WBAI.org, that...
I'm back. Leonard.
I'm just going to finish this sentence, that your donation is in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. Okay, well, we were talking about politics, but this is... Do you think people are just discreet about their politics because they...
I don't know the answer to that question. They were discreet because they didn't talk about it.
Yes.
But I was surprised, but there was not much interest in the external world. It's not just, talk about American politics, but, talk about, what was going on in Europe what people were interested in was family, religion, local sports, issues around work and farming and farm equipment, cars, and that, that was pretty much it.
So they don't have a local newspaper?
No. There is a paper in Moorestown, which is about 10, 12 miles away.
And then, of course, is the, what is it, the Indianapolis Star?
Yeah, well, Indianapolis has, yeah, right.
But politics does take on another tone. You have several long scenes of town council meetings where issues like where the water for the fire hydrant should come from are discussed and whether to allow more houses to be built in the town.
Right. Well, that's local. Sure. There's politics in that sense, and there's politics. There's suggestion about whether the town wants to expand, increase the population, encourage some industry to move in, and what that does to the tax base, and whether they want more homes built. Sure. That politics, that kind of very local politics, is discussed, but. I heard there was no mention of more general state Democratic Republican politics.
Most people in New York City never think about where the water for the fire hydrants comes from. We just assume it'll be there if there's a fire.
Right.
But in a town like Monrovia, this becomes a much more important issue than national politics.
Right. I mean, I don't know whether it's fair to characterize it as a more important issue than national politics. It's true in the sense that they don't discuss national politics, but whether they're indifferent or their issues are internalized or there's a shared point of view, I mean, I just don't know.
We also see the Lions Club deciding whether to fund a new bench outside the library and a meeting of the Freemasons honoring a member who'd reached 50 years of service. Are those the main local service organizations?
Yes.
And again,
I mean, as far as I could see.
And
right.
most of the people there are older again. Are there any organizations for younger people?
Well, I mean, there's Little League, and you know, and there are a lot of families that live there. I didn't see any organizations that where there were a lot of 25-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible they existed and I missed it.
Although there is a shot of the local motorcycle club.
Right.
And as we said earlier, seen inside the tattoo parlor.
I think in the film, you see people of all ages, actually. You see babies, you see people in high school, you see young adults, you see middle-aged people, and you see older people. The film does in no way emphasizes one age group.
We don't get a sense of much police activity, although there are allusions to police runs at the council.
Well, I went out with the police 5 times, you know, at a time when normally there's a lot of police activity in most other places, like Friday and Saturday night. And I came up with 2 speeding tickets, which I didn't use.
And that was the extent of crime in the town?
That was the extent of crime that I came across.
You include a...
You know, and there were 2 policemen. And most of the time, only one was on duty at a time. And, you know, basically they rode around all night. I'm sure occasionally there's activity. Occasionally someone gets, you know, is a medical crisis and the police assist with the ambulance and all that. And I'm sure occasionally there's a domestic violence dispute. It didn't happen with any frequency, certainly. And I just didn't luck out the night I was with the police or the nights that I was with the police.
You include it.
If that can be described as lucking out.
There's a wedding where the couple assemble a unity cross as part of the ceremony. Is that a local ritual?
I have no idea. I'd never heard of it before myself. But on the other hand, I hadn't been to that many weddings and churches.
Your signature style of filmmaking is sparse. You have no narration or captions. And at most, you'll have a shot of a business sign to let us know where we are. You've been making films that way pretty much from the start?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I like to think I've learned something over the course of 50 years, but, I mean, basically the style and the technique is the same.
And when you first started working, were you one of the only filmmakers working that way?
I think there were some others, a few others working in this style, and there are others working in this style, but not, you know, nobody quite works the same way.
And you've never been tempted to have a voiceover?
No. I haven't been tempted at all because as I may have mentioned, I think my films are more novelistic than they are journalistic, and I think my job as editor is to cut the film so that the events are self-explanatory.
The style is sometimes called cinema verite, but...
Well, that's just a pompous French term.
Yeah, you don't like that term. Why?
No, I don't like that. I don't like observational cinema. I don't like fly on the wall because I think I'm slightly more conscious than a fly.
Would you give the style a name or just say, this is what I do?
I think I make movies. Movie is a perfectly decent word.
You don't credit the individuals or institutions that you filmed in the closing credits, just the people of Monrovia.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't, you know, it's true. I didn't put in the names of the pizza parlor and the restaurant and all that. I thought that was adequate. I had thanked them personally, and I don't think it was necessary to put it in the film.
And you say that you showed them the final cut?
Yes.
What was their response?
Well, I had three screenings in Monrovia at the end of August, all staggered at different times the same night, and people seemed to like it. I mean, they, for example, the head of the Masons came up to me afterwards and said, thanked me for including the Masons. The man whose daughter got married asked me if I could give him all the outs of the wedding because the wedding photography he hired hadn't done a good job.
Did you?
You know, no, because I you know, it's a, you know, it's, if I give it to one person, I have to give it to everybody. So I explained to him that I couldn't do that.
I'm speaking to Frederick Wiseman, whose latest film, you say your 45th film?
I think that's, yeah.
Is called Monrovia, Indiana, and it opens tomorrow at Film Forum on West Housen Street. You've made films about arts organizations, courts, the military, schools, a hospital for the criminally insane. Do you have a long wish list of subjects that you want to cover?
Yeah, no, I have sort of a running list in my head of movies that I'd like to make, and when it's time to make another movie, sometimes I select something from the list, and sometimes a new idea pops into my head, and I go for that. I mean, it has to be a subject that I can feel passionate about, because I know that for the next year I'm going to be totally involved with it.
I'm not going to ask what you want to do next, but...
Thank you.
How do you decide which project to take on next?
Whatever interests me at the moment.
But
I mean, it's you know, there's no, I would hardly suggest it's a rational process. It's whatever interests me. For example, when I was about 48, I was at the dentist reading People magazine, which is the only place I read People magazine, or admit to reading People magazine. And there was an article about a model agency. So I model agency might make a good film. I thought I was at the right age to hang around a model agency. So I called up a couple of model agencies, and two of them said okay, and I went to visit them, and I picked one and made a movie for the model agency.
Have you ever chosen a topic and started filming and realized this is not going to work?
No, I've never chosen a topic where that's happened. I started to do the film that became Law and Order in Los Angeles in 1968. After a week shooting, I was told I could do whatever I wanted except ride around in the police cars. And since there were no foot patrols in Los Angeles at that time, it rather limited the story. So I went to Kansas City, where I had complete freedom to do whatever I wanted.
So you just changed the place where you shot,
yeah,
but
right.
The concept remained the same.
Yeah, right.
Making a film can be expensive. Well, it probably helps that you have a great reputation, but
well,
is funding an issue?
Yeah, it's very hard to raise the money. It's harder to raise the money now than 20 years ago because there are more people, you know, wanting to make movies, and basically the pool of money hasn't really expanded that much. But, you know, I know how to look for the money, and there are the 8 to 10 places that give money for this kind of filmmaking. I visit and talk to people, and so far... But it's a lot of work raising the money, and it's the least interesting aspect of making the movies, but it's absolutely necessary, obviously.
I understand completely, because we have to raise funds to keep WBAI going. Do people ever want to commission you to make a film about their organization?
No, that's never happened.
So you've never...
And I would never do that, because I would never want to be beholden to the people that give me the money. because I, you know, films I make, I have complete control over. Nobody sees them until they're finished. I mean, PBS doesn't see it. No foundation that gives me money sees it till it's finished. And, you know, that the funders have accepted that, and I stick to that because otherwise it's a disaster. You know, it's a potential disaster.
But your film, movie theaters are closing all over the country, and your films aren't exactly the sort of thing that people go to the Cineplex to see. In Jackson Heights is...
Well, they're making a mistake. They should be.
Jackson Heights was widely regarded as one of the best documentary films of the 21st century, but did it get much exposure?
Well, it showed... The recent films get shown in about 40 or 50 cities in America in theatrical distribution, which is very small. You know, it's not like a Tom Cruise movie, which opens in 2,500 Cineplexes, but I mean, my movies get shown in all the big cities and sometimes in smaller places, and it has about 40 to 60 theatrical runs, and then it gets shown on primetime on PBS.
Because TV also used to be a major source of documentaries. All the networks had documentary departments that no longer exist today. I guess most documentaries are either on public television, PBS, or HBO, maybe one or two of the other subscription channels. But that's pretty much it.
That is it.
And that has that limited the opportunities for people like you?
Well, it hasn't limited the opportunities. I can only speak for myself. And it hasn't limited my opportunities because PBS has always been interested in what I'm doing. They've been loyal to me, and I'm loyal to them.
But are you concerned about the future of this kind of documentary filmmaking? Have you mentored young filmmakers who are hoping to follow in your footsteps?
I don't have time for that. Only because I like to work, and keeps my mind off the Grim Reaper. So I try to do a movie every year, and when I'm not working on a movie, I like to go skiing or walk in the country or something.
I'm sure it helps that you've received so many prestigious awards, Guggenheim MacArthur Fellowships, both in getting funding and for getting access to subjects.
Well, it's certainly, I think that's helped a lot in getting funding. Whether it helps in getting access to subjects or not, I don't know. I mean, my experience is that it's pretty easy to get access to subjects. My big secret, which I'll share with your listeners, is that I ask for permission.
Mm-hmm. And then, in some cases, it doesn't work out, as you said, when you wanted to follow the police in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but it's rare that it hasn't worked out. And because, you know, Los Angeles, after a week, turned, said bye-bye, but I got in Kansas City, Missouri very easily. The chief there liked the idea, and he said, okay. And I had, complete run of the department.
And they weren't at all worried that you might wind up coming across something that would be an embarrassment?
Well, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for them, but there's a sequence in Law and Order, which is the name of the film about the police.
Before the TV series.
Before, it was before the TV series. It was 1968, before you were born even.
Not really, unfortunately.
And there's a sequence where in order to make arrest for prostitution in Kansas City at the time, the police had to have a price and an act. So the undercover policeman picks up a woman, brings her back to a hotel, they undress, he's still in his shorts, and he arrests her. And she knocks him down the stairs of the hotel. He gets on the walkie-talkie, calls the vice squad car. We're in the vice squad car. We go to the hotel. The bellboy says the woman fled to the basement. The police find her in the basement. And one of the policemen starts to strangle her in in front of the camera. And you see that in the movie. And after about 25 seconds or so, he lets her go. And she says to another policeman who's holding her arms, he, referring to the strangler, was trying to strangle me. And the other policeman says, oh, no, you were just imagining it. And, you know, anybody watching the film sees the sequence. So it's an example of police brutality. It's also, you know, illustrates police shaping up a woman who's a prostitute into the code between police and prostitutes. Well, when that movie was shown at a police chief's convention, the police chief in Kansas City at the time, who was Clarence Kelly, was attacked by other police chiefs for letting me make the movie. And much to my delight, his response was to the other chiefs, if you guys don't think that's going on in your department, you've got your head in the sand.
Nowadays,
which was completely contrary to cliche in the sense that you wouldn't expect him to give that response.
Nowadays, your competition is people with cell phones.
Right.
I mentioned that it opens tomorrow at Film Forum in New York City. We should point out that you'll be doing a number of Q&As on tomorrow at 6:30 and then on Saturday at the 3:40 show. But you mentioned earlier it's partially funded by PBS, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. When will it be shown on PBS?
Well, after the theatrical run, I would suspect next spring or early summer, not for 6 or 8 months.
And I very discreetly didn't ask you what your next project is, but do you have one?
Well, I'm thinking about one. I haven't started it yet, but I'm always. I appreciate your discretion because I don't like to talk about it until it's done.
And then when you have the idea, you will go to PBS or HBO or some other place and
say... HBO has never supported my work. I'll go to PBS. I'll go to the same places I always go to. I'll go to PBS. I'll go to ITVS, which is a branch of public television. I'll go to the Corporation Public Broadcasting and a couple of foundations that have in the past shown interest in what I'm doing.
I think New Yorkers will find...
And the Ford Foundation, for example, has been one of the principal supporters of my films for years. I mean, you know, since almost the beginning.
I was going to say, I think New Yorkers will find your portrait of small-town America fascinating, perhaps even a little horrifying at times. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you for asking me. I appreciate it very much. It's very... very nice to talk to you and very helpful for the film.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Frederick Wiseman, to Barbara Kahn, who prepared the segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.